Rob Wolf, Andy Dees, back with episode 43, The Paleolithic Solution. What in the world is happening?
Oh, man, we just took Erwan Lacour back to the airport. He hung out with us for a couple of days, so the MoveNat founder was hanging with us, had a super good time, and then we just discovered that there are living, breathing Paleo Solution books at various distribution centers right now, but unfortunately, my publisher forgot to send me a copy, so I have yet to actually see one. It was like, we just realized this morning that we sent them to everyone except you. And I'm like, no. But that's my story. What's cracking with you?
Nothing too exciting. Just got done doing some lifting. I did want to tell this story. So, you know, last week, I think it was last week. It could have been 2 weeks ago at this point. My brain is like an egg. I just got finished working out. But I pull up to the gym on one of like the afternoons where there's a break in between classes and no personal training sessions, like a Tuesday or Thursday, and there's a woman in the parking lot taking a picture of the NorCal sign. And I'm like, So I get out of my car and go over, and I'm like, hey, you know, I'm Andy, what's going on? And she's like, this is going to sound weird, but my husband, Jeff from Northern Virginia, a.k.a. listener number 20, sent me here to get him a t-shirt, and she said no one was here yet, so I wanted to take a picture for him to prove that I was actually here. So then I got her inside, showed her the shirts. I showed her the gluten is death, coffee is life shirt, and she's like, so this place is the reason why my husband won't eat gluten anymore. And I'm like, well, I don't know about this place. I think it's really Rob's fault, but anyway. So anyway,
Andy,
Jeff
is trying to distance himself from any association with me.
I'm backpedaling this poor woman. So anyway, Jeff from Northern Virginia was supposed to tell you that your wife must love you a lot to spend time on her business trip to come to the gym to look for a t-shirt. And since she initially couldn't get in the gym, she was taking pictures to validate that she was actually there.
And it was like 115 that day. So, wow.
Yeah. I like it. It's listener number 20, Rob. They're growing one or two a month.
I don't believe it. Listener six, that's what we're capping it. So.
Six listeners, can't be wrong, Rob.
That's right.
All right. Well, are you ready for episode 43? Because we already answered, the question. Well, the ultimate question, I can never remember. But I love the video clip from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. That always makes me laugh.
Yeah.
All right. Are you ready?
I'm sure I can botch this in classic, ability here. So yeah, let's roll it. Let's roll it.
Cool. All right. So the first question I got via Facebook from Liz. So I wanted to include the subject line because I thought it was funny. So subject line was, "If you can't help, I'm calling Bruce Wayne." And Liz says, "Hi, Mr. Dees. I recently went to the Paleolithic Solutions Seminar in Arlington via Kansas City and Ruts program and have been a Paleo Lights Out convert for some time. I'm sure I'm the first person to send you a question via Facebook, hoping to have you or Rob in your infinite wisdom answer it." Actually, you're not the first person, but I'm sure I'll get...
There's a bunch every day.
I'm sure I'll get more now. But anyway... Yeah. Due to the fact that I suffer from narcissistic personality disorder, I'm also sure this is the most important question you've ever received.
That stuff is really going around.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, once you put it in the internet, Rob, it'll never come back. And that I am the most important out of your X number of listeners. If you or Rob can answer, whether podcast or personally, I'd be grateful. A dear friend has been on Ambien for 2 years, can't sleep without it, is perpetually stressed and working 12-hour days, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. on a fast-paced job. She suffered through a bout of shingles last year and is now dealing with calcium oxalate kidney stones for the third time and in extreme pain. At the ripe old age of 26, she's now on painkillers, bladder meds, Ambien, and birth control to top it all off. She's not overweight but doesn't have much time to work out, and when she does, it's in long spin classes or hour-long PT sessions at the Globo Gym. I'm so fearful that she'll drive herself over the edge because she's so sick and stressed and despairing of her docs. She's come to me for advice, but I don't know where to start the triage or what kind of things may be going on under the hood due to her medications and physical condition. I truly fear her for her life if this continues. How do we get her off the Ambien, back to sleep, regulate cortisol, mitigate the kidney stones, ... and what comes first? I don't want to make recommendations to her because the internet is so full of conflicting advice for kidney stone management, protein intake, and certain paleo staples like spinach and broccoli. Please help if you can."
Wow. I would go out on a limb and probably guess that some of her calcium metabolism problems are probably cortisol and insulin mediated. Without seeing exactly what she's eating, it would be tough to tell, you know, if she's not getting like a big oxalic acid intake, you know, like Liz mentioned from the broccoli and the spinach, although broccoli doesn't have a lot of oxalates in it. I mean, this is the like, you know, Titanic heading towards the iceberg in a lot of ways. And it's just almost impossible to get a handle on it until you know, the day-to-day stress is typically what's driving things. And so then you're up early, work all day, get into bed late, totally stressed out. And it just, I feel like I'm almost copping out here, but I mean, this is like big life change that needs to happen. There's a bunch of stuff going on, like the wheels are falling off the wagon in somebody who should be like really healthy, young, vibrant. This stuff should not be happening. And I would go out on a limb and probably say that some of the kidney stones are probably somewhat cortisol and insulin related, in that it ends up stripping some calcium out of the bones. A good way to verify that is if she has any type of like osteoporosis brewing. So like if she was below normal levels on a DEXA scan, that would be a really, really heavy indicator that there's probably some metabolic element to this. There are definitely some genetic features of kidney stones. The whole protein intake deal, you know, the acid load is a piece of it, but when you really look at the fundamental pieces of this whole thing, I think she just got to get a control on the whole lifestyle. And I honestly don't know where to start. I mean, one of those fundamental questions is just like, why is this person working an 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. job? And I say that having run a gym for, you know, like 6 years and probably the first 4.5 years of it, that's exactly what we were doing. You know, we were up at 5 in the morning at the gym by like 5:45, run the gym all day, deal with blogs, deal with writing articles. This is back when we had the performance menu. We were involved with that. Then back at the gym in the afternoon, evening, and then button up everything, get home at like 8:30 or 9, try to stuff some food down us, and then get into bed and do it all over again. But it really lit a fire under us. It lit a fire under me to figure out some way to get that thing in a sustainable place, such that we weren't there all the time, and that we could either do our training in the morning or do the training in the evening. And eventually we ended up doing a lot more traveling, and we're not down there that much. Nikki does a lot more specific like class teaching than I do, but you just really have to reevaluate the lifestyle and figure out where this thing is going. I mean, this is some really deep-seated fundamental stuff that needs to be addressed, because there's definitely some problems brewing here.
Any thoughts on just general diet for someone in this situation?
I still think that kind of lowish carb paleo is good to go. If you're really concerned about oxalate precipitation, you know, the calcium oxalate crystals, then you stick more with actually like broccoli and carrots and beets and things like that, and stick, you know, kind of shy away from spinach, kale, collards. More the green tops, or like the tops of plants, are more the oxalate containing items. So you could find low oxalate vegetable matter and then just do your kind of standard paleo shtick. But I really think that it's a bunch of lifestyle stuff here.
Yep. All right. Good question.
Man, yeah, holy cats.
Whew. Holy cats, someone just had a drink. Okay. Number two, question from the legendary Dallas of Hole 9.
The most well-coiffed Canadian we've ever met. There are some very well-coiffed Canadians.
True. And they all seem to be very lean. I don't know what's going on with that.
I don't know.
So he starts, dudes. Rob, you probably already know a ton about this topic already, but the concept that antioxidant supplementation, such as 1 gram of vitamin C daily, could stymie training-induced adaptation was all new to me. So that made me wonder, at what point or to what degree does antioxidant supplementation versus the broad range of hormetic phytochemicals with antioxidant effects in real food Amyloid, some of the effects of exercise in terms of insulin sensitivity in mitohormesis. We've recently published two posts on the Whole Nine site addressing questions that we've received about various supplements and recovery drinks, and we've taken a bit of a hard line with our responses, essentially stating that you're always best to eat real food, fresh food, and that it is very likely the potential benefits of any fancy-schmancy supplement are dramatically overstated, oversimplified, or simply inaccurate. I was wondering if you had a thought on using alpha-lipoic acid, the only antioxidant we currently use, and whether the benefits for healthy, exercising, non-metabolically deranged, clean-eating folks like you and I still outweigh the potential blunting of beneficial training-induced adaptations. I get that it's a situational pro versus con, but would you recommend continuing the use of ALA in light of articles like these? Thanks again for everything you do, dude. Looking forward to inhaling the advanced copy of the book soon. Best, Dallas.
And if you've ever seen Dallas eat, then you would believe he could, in fact, eat the book, all 330 pages of it. So, even before we jump in on this, Melissa and Dallas put together some really phenomenal, 30-day kind of meal intervention type things. They have some really cool stuff cooking over at Whole Nine. So if folks haven't checked them out, WholeNineLife.com, definitely give them a look-see and see what they've got cooking. As to the antioxidant deal, you know, like alpha-lipoic acid just does so many cool things, and it's actually, if I were to supplement with antioxidants, I would go something like alpha-lipoic acid, silymarin, which is like a milk thistle extract. Both of these things work at the liver. Like alpha-lipoic acid is individually an antioxidant. It's both a fat and water-soluble antioxidant, so that's kind of cool. But it plays a really important role in recharging vitamin E, vitamin C. It's a cofactor in this huge cascade, this kind of symphony of antioxidants, and they all tie into glutathione, which is kind of our main endogenous antioxidant, although there are other antioxidant systems in our body for sure. But that's kind of this very stout, very important system that we have. But when you are supporting the production of other antioxidant species by providing like alpha-lipoic acid, selenium, a little bit of vitamin E dietarily and whatnot, I think that you're doing a really good thing in that regard, in that you're not overwhelming the body with any one mega dose of an antioxidant. So we're not overwhelming one metabolic pathway or one particular type of antioxidant activity, or even like tissue specificity, because these things end up in different places in tissues and within cells. So you don't necessarily want to like overwhelm one of those systems versus another. And then it just plays much more symphonically, much more in line with eating real food. And this is really the deal with alpha-lipoic acid anyway, is that we should be getting this out of grass-fed meat. So like of the whole spectrum of things, the alpha-lipoic acid I would feel totally comfortable with. I've seen a couple of supplements that combine like some alpha-lipoic acid, some selenium, which isn't specifically an antioxidant, but it's an important cofactor in the production of glutathione, and then silymarin, which again is a milk thistle extract, which is an antioxidant, and it aids in the production of liver-derived antioxidants like glutathione. And so I could see an argument for maybe adding a little bit of that stuff in the mix and probably being okay. But interestingly, all of that stuff ends up being essentially like food extractives. You know, it's not a gram of vitamin C that we're getting as an example. So I would feel pretty comfortable with that.
For folks that aren't aware, Rob, do you want to take a step back and talk a little bit about this concept of the antioxidant supplementation stymieing some of the training-induced adaptations?
Sure. Well, stepping way, way back, like, late 80s, early 90s, we started becoming more aware of this stuff, oxidative damage and free radicals. And we recognized that there's this type of damage that can, chemical reaction, you have oxidation or reduction reactions in organic and biological systems, and oxidation products of certain reactions, like generating energy out of the mitochondria of our cells, can have free electrons just kind of spin out, and these things are highly, highly reactive. And there are some other really reactive species like superoxide and stuff like that. But if they come in contact with proteins or DNA or like a cell membrane, they just tear it up. They cause a ton of damage. And things like smoking and automobile exhaust and these things are full of what they call reactive oxygen species. So we discovered that this stuff was bad and that it might be a cofactor in aging. And so then it was thought, well, shoot, we'll just supplement with tons of antioxidants, and then this stuff will be dealt with, and this might be a ticket to the fountain of youth. But the unfortunate thing is just didn't happen at all. So, high-dose antioxidant supplementation did not increase life or really decrease disease rates. And in fact, in certain situations, it seemed like it was making organisms sick. And this is this concept of mitohormesis, which is that when we exercise, if we go and undergo a little bit of fasting, any type of a stress can potentially have some benefit associated with it, in that it immunizes us against subsequent stresses, and it just causes an adaptive response. Our system needs to overcome it, and that is actually a beneficial thing for us. And so what we're finding now is that perhaps things like antioxidant supplementation in the peri-workout window or immediately post-workout or something like that may actually be quenching some of the adaptive response to exercise, even to some degree training with a fully glycogen-loaded muscular system all the time, maybe quenching some of the adaptive response that we have to exercise. There's some very good indications that smart, fasted training improves adaptation to exercise. Some of that adaptation is increasing the amount of glycogen that we store, and some of it, interestingly, is improving the production of our endogenous, our self-produced antioxidant stores. And it is interesting, even though we're talking about antioxidant supplementation hasn't really been shown to improve health or lifespan, there are some really interesting situations in which I think it's mainly been flies and some smaller critters thus far, but they increase the amount of glutathione, which we were just talking about a second ago, which is one of our own endogenous antioxidants. Superoxide dismutase is another endogenous antioxidant. With genetic manipulation, critters have been made such that they have two or three times the level of superoxide dismutase or glutathione, and these critters end up living significantly longer, sometimes two or three times longer than normal. So there is some efficacy to dealing with antioxidants or free radicals in an effective way, but you need to do it in a way that's biodynamic, in a way that doesn't stymie other processes in the body. So... And now everybody's asleep, so we can just wrap it all up now.
All right, moving on. I'm sure we'll get questions on that, because that is a complicated issue.
Yeah, that'll be a great at the whiteboard thing.
Short answer is eat real food.
Eat real food, yeah.
Okay. Question three. This is a question from Rob with 1B. I was wondering if you had some good resources for diabetics and how the paleo diet can help. I have two friends at work who have diabetes but are following the recommended AMA dietary plan. I'm trying to tell them to take a look at paleo, but they went to the classes and that is what they recommend. It is frustrating to see people still using conventional wisdom and still believing what the nutritionists, dietitians tell them. Can you help? I am frustrated but want to help them since paleo has made a big difference in the way I perform and feel about myself besides losing weight and really trimming up. Thanks.
You know, I cover this pretty good in the Paleo Solution, which hopefully pretty quick the book's going to be available. So that's definitely going to be a good resource for people. Dr. Bernstein's Diabetes Solution is a really good book. If he were in, this might be something to collaborate with the guy on. He really addresses a lot of like the medication issues and things like that very, very well. But he doesn't make I'm getting all stumbled up here. He recommends a ketogenic diet for both type 1 and type 2 diabetes, which is very, very effective, but he doesn't make a distinction with things like saltine crackers and gluten inputs, which I think for a lot of people, that's a huge piece to this. Like, there are certain people with type 1 diabetes that still have pancreatic function. Like, there was just a paper recently that showed that some people who've had type 1 diabetes, the autoimmune form of diabetes, for upwards of 20 years still had some pancreatic function. And so there's an opportunity here with both people who have had type 1 diabetes for a long time or people who've developed it recently and they're in what's called a honeymoon phase, that they can reverse this stuff. And so what that's a piece of this. If these folks are type 1 diabetics, it is much more challenging to deal with this than it is dealing with a type 2 diabetic. And I forget which podcast it was, but I said something to the effect that type 2 diabetes was effectively like mismanaged diet, and I had somebody just crawl up my hoo-ha. And then it turned out that really what they had was this hybrid form of type 1 and type 2 diabetes, because the way that she responded to food was totally atypical with a type 2 diabetic. It was classic kind of type 1 diabetic, and when she did a little investigating in that stuff, it was pretty obvious that she had a lot more going on with this than what she thought. So if it's a type 2 diabetic, then if they went kind of low-carb paleo, they could actually put this stuff into reversal. Like, it is wholly a state of metabolic derangement. You can reverse that stuff dependent upon how severe their damage is. But I mean, certainly changing the way that they're eating away from American Medical Association recommendations would be hugely beneficial. If they're type 1 diabetic, then they need to be a little bit more careful about how they tackle this stuff. I've had several blog posts on type 1 diabetes. And then I kind of have a sense that I need to do like an ebook or like a 20-step PDF of how to manage this, because we get a ton of questions on how to deal with the type 1 diabetes specifically. Exercise, stress, all that sort of jive. So it really depends on what type flavor diabetic you have. But either way, lowish carb paleo is going to be way more beneficial for these folks than what they're eating right now. I can guarantee that. Like, we could change their A1Cs dramatically just with a month and a half of intervention.
Yep. All right, cool. Good question.
Yeah.
Next, we got a question from Michelle. Hi, Rob. Only up to episode 22, so hope this is not answered later. My son's diet has included soy as well as meat since he was very young, as I was a vegetarian for 15 years. I've recently changed from the zone to paleo and seeing many benefits. No longer vegetarian. My son, who is 8 now, had a parasite when he was 5 for about a year that made him unable to eat fatty food without waking in the night and throwing up. Sorry, can't remember the name of the parasite. We also thought dairy was a problem. He was given antibiotics for 2 months and since has had no problems. He has had slightly raised bumps on his upper arms and cheeks from about the age of 2, which doctors said he would grow out of. He loves food and is slightly overweight compared to his friends. He is not obese. I now make mostly paleo meals in the morning and night. However, he still has bread for lunch. He still has soy milk, however, not that often, and hardly any dairy. Questions. Could the years of soy had an effect on him as he was growing? Do parasites only attack an already weak immune system? Do you think the spots and extra weight are because of the soy, grains, or dairy, or all of them? I know the easy thing would be to take them out. However, it's not so easy in an 8-year-old. Would like to feel like I had a good reason. Can't wait for the book. Many thanks, Michelle. One of your 5 Australian fans. Also have to thank you for my ability to now breathe in the morning after giving up oats and all the other health benefits of giving up grains.
Well, gee whiz. That's very super nice. So number one, could the years of soy have an effect on how he was growing? There's definitely some phytoestrogen issues with soy. I honestly don't know how much is any given brand of soy milk and whatnot. Xenoestrogens, phytoestrogens are definitely a potential problem. They can be a problem with thyroid. Whether or not that's a problem for him, I have no idea. Parasites do not only attack weakened immune systems, really. To some degree, we're probably wired up to have some small degree of parasitic infestation. Like, there's some thought that some of our tendency towards autoimmunity is actually worsened because of a lack of parasites, but that makes it a little bit hard to recommend giving everybody tapeworms to potentially ameliorate that. So, parasites are just kind of endemic in the natural free living world when you don't have antimicrobials to get rid of them. The spots and extra weight, I don't know. I mean, it could be the gluten is just such a problematic item, and it's kind of funny because we've just had I had that interview at T Nation, and I've just been dealing with a bunch of very cranky people over there. It's really funny because I received an email from somebody in the know from T Nation, and apparently the people who were totally assailing me on that article are all registered dietitians, which is really kind of funny to get some background on that, but at this point, I'm almost gun shy to tell somebody to avoid gluten for their health because I'm just tired of getting hand grenades lobbed at me. But I mean, if she is experiencing such significant improvements in her health, then I can guarantee you that the kid would. And it's as hard as you don't buy the stuff anymore, and you control whatever meals you can control at home, and just see what happens. You give it a couple of weeks, couple of months, and see what happens. No, you're probably not going to be able to control everything when he goes over to a friend's house and all that sort of stuff. But it's this thing again where, like, if you suspect that your kid is getting exposed to something that's probably not healthy for him or her, do you want to limit that exposure, or do you just not care about the frequency of that exposure? And I would get in and give it a shot. I think it's worthwhile. And I know the kid thing is real dodgy, but I would definitely give it a shot.
Yeah, and I think that's why we always go back to it. Try it for 30 days, see how you feel, add it back in, and see what happens. You know, we're not saying you have to give up everything tomorrow for the rest of your life.
Yeah, and the gluten deal is just so big. We need to do probably another podcast later at some point about, Chrissy, our my sister-in-law, her little guy has been pretty paleoed out, like his whole way through. He's almost 2 years old now, has been doing really, really well. And then they gave him some gluten-free waffles maybe 2 weeks ago. And he had like one gluten-free waffle. And then the next day, all that he wanted to eat was that waffle. And he normally is this like super mellow, really cool kid, and he's super bright, really, really ahead of the curve for where he should be for his age. And when he wouldn't eat anything at all because he wanted that waffle so bad. So he went to bed hungry. They wouldn't feed. They said you can have like chicken or fish or, you know, whatever it was they were having for dinner. He didn't want that, so he went to bed hungry. Got up the next day, still wanted the waffle, wouldn't eat his normal breakfast, and then finally by lunch, like basically he had gone almost 24 hours without eating, he finally got in and ate like blueberries and ground beef and stuff like that. And normally this kid eats like crazy. Like he's a super good eater, he's not fussy, he's not problematic, but they gave him one kind of gluten-free waffle and they started having problems with that immediately, just from kind of like the addictive side of that. And occasionally we'll have somebody make the argument, well, shouldn't we give them some a little bit here and there because when he gets exposed to it, you want him to be toughened up to it or something like that. But I think it's kind of a silly proposition. I would try to minimize the exposure. Like if and when I have kids, that's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to make them neurotic about their food if they go over to friends, you know. It's kind of all bets are off at that point. But to the degree I can control that stuff at home, I'm just going to have good options at home, and they can eat what we fix, and that's going to kind of be that.
Yep. All right, good. Next, we got a question from Brian T. Hey, Rob. Holy cats. One of your 7 listeners asked about antihistamine's effect on quality of sleep, and you said you would get to it. I'm guessing from your response you have something to say about it, so here's my attempt to shake you down for the information. My sister is staying with me for 10 months, and she has 2 large cats with massive fur coats, which they shed during the summer. So lately I've been taking Claritin daily, and I was trying to fight it, but my quality of sleep was decreasing due to my allergies. I train Olympic lifting 4 days a week, so my quality of sleep is extremely important to me. What do you think?
For Benadryl specifically, it blocks growth hormone release. Whenever you block histamine production is actually a cofactor in growth hormone production. And so I have not mapped out the pathway for this on Claritin, but if Claritin is a histamine blocker to whatever degree, then you're going to get a very similar kind of growth hormone suppression. You could certainly give it a shot, and this is kind of a trade-off back and forth. It's kind of like, so I can't sleep well because I'm dying from my allergies and I can't breathe, or my sleep isn't quite as restorative because I'm maybe not producing as much growth hormone and my sleep isn't as restorative. I think that's something you're just going to have to play around with. A little bit of intermittent fasting can help that. Quercetin, which you can get out of fruits and vegetables, or you can get a supplement of quercetin, has some pretty cool kind of anti-inflammatory effects that seem to tie around like mast cells related to immune response. Mike Malloy might have some ideas on this too, our kind of resident PhD in immunology, who actually tracked down a great paper on the etiology of a nickel allergy. And so a show or two down the road, we'll look at that again, because we had a question about nickel allergy a while back. So that's my thought, is just kind of play with both options, maybe play with a little intermittent fasting, and then definitely keep the fruit and vegetable intake high, and really minimize any other problematic foods, grains, legumes, dairy. Anytime you get some immune irritation, then you get more immune irritation. So if you're subjected to the cats, but you're still doing some dairy or something like that, I'll suspect if you pull the dairy out that you're going to improve with regards to the severity of the allergies.
Yep. Cool. Next, we got a question from Matt. Rob, Matt from CrossFit Champions here. Got a question for you. We are constantly promoting the paleo diet to our athletes with varying degrees of success. Can't wait for your book, by the way. We are not real big on supplements other than fish oil and a post-workout protein shake, but clients are always asking us about supplements. As much as I hate it, I even have some saying, what about such and such affiliate that promotes Advocare? Personally, I think Advocare is nicely marketed shit, but that's me. I just wanted to ask what all supplements you use and recommend. Thanks for your time. Hope all is well.
Damn you, Andy. Sneaking in supplement questions.
Well, Rob, I just want to say that with the impending book tour, that the long podcast on supplements looks like it's the horizon is getting further and further away. So I thought I'd just throw this in there, let you give a spin on it. I assume you touch on this briefly in the book, although I don't know, I haven't seen it.
No, smarty pants, I have a whole chapter on supplements, actually. but this is a good way to sneak some in anyway. Matt's a really good dude. CrossFit Champions is a great gym. If folks have a chance to train with those folks, they're fully legit, really, really good. Advocare has some good stuff, and it has some other stuff that I wouldn't really recommend for folks. The fact that it's an MLM makes me a little bit creeped out too. There's just always kind of a weird element to that. Apologies to people who are into MLM. That's just my dealio. So that's just kind of the way it is. I just see really limited application for supplements. Magnesium, like a natural calm, magnesium citrate to help with sleep. Vitamin D, if folks aren't getting enough sunlight, which that's almost everybody. Vitamin D3. Fish oil, if we're not getting in good amounts of grass-fed meat and wild-caught fish. There's a lot of herbal extracts and stuff like that that I really, really like for kind of specific situations. Some people respond really well to tribulus. They just feel better. Libido improves and stuff like that. But it's a very select thing. You know, for like a shotgun recommendation, I'm pretty limited on that. I read through a bunch of Martin Berkham stuff. Like, I really read through the whole Lean Gain site a couple of days ago, and really good material. And it's kind of interesting. He doesn't recommend hardly any supplements at all. Some branched chain amino acids, occasionally like a protein shake if you're really hard pressed. But it's interesting. He's kind of tinkered with a ton of different things, and he found that real food works better than shakes. Short, intense workouts with long rest periods in between, chasing performance goals, not beating yourself into a bloody pulp, that those are the routes to success. You know, incremental progress, big eating when you eat, a little bit of intermittent fasting to improve insulin sensitivity. And I'm not saying that he's 100% right. I'm not saying I'm 100% right on this, but it's just intriguing to me that if you don't start this thing from kind of first principles that I'm selling stuff to people, then I think the likelihood of the information being a little bit more credible is there. And we're involved with paleo brands, so I'm selling like jerky and paleo cookies and stuff like that. So I mean, maybe I'm suspect now too, but it's still that stuff was an attempt at it, as close to real food as we could get. You know, is like some snack food, some prepared food. If I saw shakes and stuff like that really, really work quantitatively better than real food, then I would definitely jump on board with it. But I just don't see it. And honestly, when we start looking at like shakes versus like whole milk, I see the whole milk work as well or better than the shakes. Most of the studies that have been done comparing chocolate milk with various types of shakes, it shows the chocolate milk works better than the shakes do for improving, reversing catabolism, dropping cortisol, improving glycogen synthesis in the muscles and stuff like that. And there's a couple of, there's one particular brand floating around out there right now that claims that you can do your hardest leg workout today, take the supplement, and then do the same leg workout tomorrow and replicate it. And it's just hogwash. It is absolute hyperbole hogwash. I could have been a spokesperson for that whole thing and probably made a chunk of change off of it. But then the credibility is gone. You know, I would rather tell people what works, and like they'll buy a book, they'll go to a seminar, and you know, at the end of the day, I can just kind of look myself in the mirror. So Matt, and you know, it's interesting. Matt's a really good coach. Matt and Pam are really good coaches. They take this stuff really seriously, and I really appreciate the fact that they care enough to ask some questions about this and also to kind of ride their folks' fannies. If there was an easier way, then we'd recommend it. I would recommend it. It's not like I'm trying to be some iconoclast and make people you know, suffer because they have to cook food and stuff like that. But sticking food in a blender and drinking it doesn't work as well as eating real food. And I wish it wasn't the case, because then I could sell supplements and make money off of it. But I can't in good faith do that. So I guess that's my thought on all that jive. And I'm sure I have so many people that are going to want to shoot me at some point here. So,
and I feel like if you look at, you know, our gym specifically, like look at our hard hitting athletes, I think you see a fair amount of rotation between milk products post workout, shakes post workout, and real food. And honestly, I don't think most folks notice anything magical about the shakes. And when you talk to them, some of them are like, you know what, I'm lazy today. It's a convenience thing. Some of our fighters do it because it's easier and sometimes a little more portable, but haven't seen any magic results where all of a sudden their max squat went up 13.2% when they started supplementing with the latest cool protein powder.
No. And I mean, I just spent thousands of dollars on this stuff. Like I've done everything except anabolic steroids, and I should have probably only done anabolic steroids, you know,
because it would work.
It would have actually worked, and I could have spent all of those thousands of dollars on supplements and everything and gone to Mexico and had like La Farmacia, you know. But it's just really limited what stuff works. I wish it wasn't the case, but it you know, there's a few things that are kind of cool, but again, more in the realm of kind of like herbals and like some adaptogens. We have a question about an adaptogen, I think, that pops up here in a little bit. But those get real kind of specific, and I'm reticent to just shotgun recommend them, because people will inevitably forego eating real food and taking the time to prepare food. And like, there's a whole other piece of this thing, the like cultural community element of like sitting down and eating food and like carving out a piece of your day to do that, and like hopefully spending some time with quality people while you consume some of that food instead of just like shoveling it down and while you're driving or something. So
yep. I want to tell you, Rob, as well, that I don't know if you can tell, but I can read the questions a little clearer because I stopped putting cream in my coffee, and it's really sad every time I do, because I know that I'm not so mucousy, but it just tastes so dang good. So no cream in my coffee. I can talk better, sleep better. It's stunning. Works.
And it's tough. It's one of those things. It's so yummy, but I noticed the same thing. I totally noticed.
Really makes me sad. So anyway, next we got a question from Brian. Hi, Rob. My wife and I just discovered we're going to be having a baby next year. She's about 4 weeks along. Being the paleo couple for about a year now that we are, we really don't like to buy into much conventional wisdom. If it happens to be right, great, but I like to research things and not just blindly follow. I love your podcast, and I think what you do is just amazing. We have learned a lot, more than you'd probably expect. I've been one of your 6 listeners since your first podcast, the ever-rotating list of 6 listeners. I wanted to get your take on eating seafood while pregnant. It seems like the general suggestion is to avoid fish that are higher in mercury and limit it to just a few times per week. Then I got to wondering what people who live on islands and in coastal villages did. I'm sure the bulk of their protein came from sea fare, and their kids were probably fine. She gets a lot of her protein from different kinds of fish as well as canned wild salmon. I am working on researching this further, but wanted to get your take. Thanks.
You know, the methylmercury problem, and I did some research on this. Part of the issue here is like coal production coal burning releases a fair amount of just either elemental mercury or different mercury compounds into the environment. And these things aren't in and of themselves that toxic, but what happens is that different sea life, one-celled or small-celled sea life, converts inorganic mercury or different mercury compounds into methyl mercury, and methyl mercury is really, really nasty. It's nasty in that it tends to conglomerate around neurological tissues, tends to denature the proteins associated with neurological tissues, which is basically you know cooking your brain kind of stuff. And then also it has a really nasty tendency to bioaccumulate and work its way up to larger and larger critters. So I'm not really sure what island folks did in the past, but it wasn't really that big a problem. This has become more of a problem as just basically like ocean water, ocean life has become more contaminated. And so the tendency to eat further down the food chain is pretty important, I think, if you're eating fish pretty frequently. I couldn't really track any information down on this, but there might be also like some kind of wisdom inherent in kind of like Hawaiian cultures, Filipino cultures, you know, any type of like island peoples where maybe pregnant women were eating just kind of instinctively less potentially toxic, you know, critters that would have less potential for bioaccumulation. But it's definitely a real deal. You definitely want to be concerned with it. Unfortunately, you know, like tuna is kind of a big problem with that. Atlantic salmon, I think, is much more contaminated than Pacific salmon. The larger the fish is, the more the problematic the situation is. So it's a real thing. Fish oil isn't an issue because we've mentioned in previous podcasts the mercury cannot really associate with the lipid part, the fat part of the fish oil, so it's not really a problem.
Yep. All right, good. Next, we got a question from Bethany. Hi, Rob. I'm 12 weeks into doing CrossFit. Started at 253 pounds, 37 years old, 5'5", female. Been eating Paleo Primal about 80% of the time, working to get those ratios up, and CrossFitting about 4 times a week and walking 1 to 2 times a week. As of today, I've lost 17 pounds. Best of all, I feel great, but I feel great about myself and my energy is phenomenal. I had my body fat tested at week 4. I had it retested at week 12, 8-week span in between. In those 8 weeks, I lost 10 pounds of body fat, 9% of my total body fat, but only 1.8% overall, but stayed exactly the same on my muscle. I'm okay with the fat loss, but concerned about not gaining muscle. The tester said that people with a lot of fat to lose usually lost muscle too until they got closer to their goal weight. He said it was great I maintained my muscle, however, I feel my muscle growing, or maybe I have lost fat so I can feel muscle now, ha. Regardless, I don't resonate with that answer. Is it true only average weight people can gain muscle? How would that work scientifically?
I wasn't super sure on this. Like, is she asking like she wants to gain muscle or?
All right. Well, and then let me go to the next part. Sorry, I forgot part two. And she says, yeah. I suspect I'm not taking enough protein. I'm doing the nutrition component and we are going to review it again. But I want to know from your view if there's any legitimate reason why I would not be gaining muscle based on the amount of weight I have to lose. As I wrote this, I just thought maybe as I carry less fat, I am losing muscle because I don't need as much to carry all the fat. But I'm not sure that's right either. So I want an informed opinion so I don't drive myself crazy with false information. Thanks. Hope to see you in Atlanta, Bethany. Right now, I have 134 pounds of lean muscle and 104 pounds of body fat.
Okay. So one big factor in this is what was the method used to track body composition. Some of the bioimpedance scans, like you're almost better off going and getting an astrological reading from Madame Ruby down in downtown Chico. Like, so that's a really big factor. Like, simply having different electrolyte levels, being dehydrated versus well hydrated, can really alter the appearance of how much lean body mass you have. So That would be something that would be really important to know. If strength training is new for Bethany, even if she's on a bit of a caloric restricted diet, even if she's not eating like a huge amount of protein, it's probably pretty reasonable that she would gain some muscle out of this. The fact that she's lost a significant amount of body fat already, which I mean, just totally crushing this. This is super cool. If she's just maintaining, apparently maintaining muscle mass, or potentially gaining a little bit, then I wouldn't be super concerned with that. But again, there's the factor of I don't know for sure what method she's using to track body fatness. So I'm reticent to say one way or the other, like without knowing what type of method was used. Was it calipers? Is the person doing calipers really all that good? If it was something like a bod pod or something, it can be accurate, but that's only if the bod pod is calibrated at a consistent basis, which I never see people calibrate these things with any consistency. So I don't know. Like all I would care about is that you're making progress. I don't really care. Like performance improves. You fit in your clothes better. Done. That's all I would care about personally. And that's maybe a hollow answer because folks want to quantify more, but that's where I would personally take the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think we generally say if you're improving in the gym and clothes are fitting better, I don't even care about the scale. The body fat stuff, as you said, depending on what type of methodology you're using, can be pretty inaccurate. And generally, I think for most folks, not worth it to use one of the really accurate methods unless they're competing or have some weird bet with their neighbor with whether they can legitimately get to 5.2% body fat.
Yeah, I mean, if you are just really numbers focused, you know, and like you just geek on that, then I guess it could be kind of cool. But it seems like then I would just rather see people get into the process, enjoy your training, have some performance goals, eat well, enjoy your food, enjoy your life, sleep well, you know, like make this stuff fun and make it happy and don't overcomplicate it. I guess there may be some personality types out there that really want to quantify stuff, but I just don't see that working in the long haul. Like I when people love what they're doing, then it's easy. When people are just playing to a number that they're trying to achieve, it's oftentimes a very hollow and transient success. So I would rather see you latch on to the long-term success of just looking, feeling, performing good, having good biomarkers, and call it good with that.
Yep. All right. Next, we got a question from Chuck. Rob, haven't been able to keep up with the site as much in the past. Regardless, I just came across the December 2009 University of Michigan study on energy deficit after exercise augments lipid mobilization but does not contribute to exercise-induced increase in insulin sensitivity. If I understand correctly, this seems to just further support increased carbohydrate consumption post-workout versus energy-deficient post-workout meals. Did I get that correct?
Yeah, totally. I would totally agree with that, yeah.
Cool. That was easy, Chuck.
So there's a concern that post-workout carbohydrate intake could somehow blunt insulin sensitivity, and I don't think that that's a huge concern unless we're going really wild on like kind of fructose containing items. Matt Lalonde and I talked about this a fair amount at one point, and I particularly for people who are training hard, people who might be dealing with potential cortisol management issues and stuff like that, I think some post-workout carbs, like this has still just kind of been my gig. Like it looks a lot like Berardi's old massive eating, and like it can either be maintenance level or a gain level, or for that matter, it could be leaning out. But if you're going to have some carbs, doing them post-workout is a not bad place to do it. And again, like reading the lean gain stuff, like Martin ends up recommending that upwards of 80% of one's calories would be consumed in the post-workout window. And that's not necessarily just an hour, but like of your day, whenever you train, ideally most of your calories would be consumed post-workout. I think that makes a ton of sense. It really falls into a lot of the old bodybuilding stuff. I remember Steve Shafley had an article that he posted on the performance menu board ages ago about a study that showed that eating a really large whack of protein post-workout seemed to be your best bet for increasing protein synthesis and like seemed to improve recovery and all that. And I'm kind of buying that. Like the big aggressive post-workout feeding, little bit of intermittent fasting and stuff like that, I'm really liking that approach.
80% of my calories post-workout. Wow.
Not necessarily in one meal.
Right.
Ideally. And it gets hard. Like, if you train in the evening, that's just not going to happen, probably. So,
probably.
There's caveats to that. But to the degree you can construct things in that way, it seems to work well. Better body composition, better recovery, all that sort of jive.
Yep. Cool. Huh. All right. Next, we got a question from Lucky Listener 13. Rob, thanks so much for what you do. I have a supplement question. If it has to wait for your supplement podcast, I will wait. But until then, I believe I am Lucky Listener 13. Sorry, Andy, it's still funny. No, it's not. But anyway, while speaking with a naturopathic MD about stress and preventing adrenal burnout, he suggested the use of the supplement. I don't even know. How do you say that, Rob?
Eleutherococcus. It's Siberian ginseng.
Oh, okay. He claims it would improve athletic performance. The crazy Russians use it prior to the Olympics to gain an advantage, decrease adrenal burnout, and help with stress my body is under from working nights in the emergency department. From the research I have done, it seems that there are few side effects, and the only precaution is to get it from a reputable source to ensure quality. Have you had any experience with this type of supplement or know anything that I might be missing from my research? Thanks.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Eleutherococcus, rhodiola, cordyceps. There's a number of really legit adaptogens out there. An adaptogen just basically enhances an organism's ability to deal with a stress, whether it's psychological stress, physical stress. It tends to improve the way that the organism responds to that stress. I'm blanking on the name of some stuff. James Fitzgerald, OPT, really recommends it. It's by Orthomolecular Research, I think. I can totally see the bottle in my head. It's listed on his site. We'll try to put it in the show notes. But that's a really phenomenal blend from Eleutherococcus, rhodiola, couple other adaptogens in there, some licorice. Licorice is really synergistic with all this stuff because it improves the retention of cortisol in the body via shutting down a breakdown in the liver in the AM. And so that can be beneficial for people who are starting to get in that tired and wired kind of scenario where they're real flat and lethargic during the AM and then kind of perky in the PM and it messes with their sleep. So that's an outstanding adaptogen blend that has Eleutherococcus. I can't remember the total content. Rhodiola, Eleutherococcus, licorice, and a couple other goodies in there. But it's really good. I used it quite a bit after the Poliquin Biosignature gig when he was recommending that I get my ducks in a row and get my cortisol issues dealt with. And it was quite helpful. And I know James recommends it to a lot of folks. It's only available in Canada, though, and it's pricey. It's like $40 a can.
Wow. Well, then it's magic. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know. I've never tried it.
Yeah, and you know, the thing with all that stuff, though, it's kind of funny. Usually about the time you start needing it, you realize, oh, man, I've been skimping on my sleep. Oh, I've been, you know, not as solid with monitoring training volume and stuff like that. So it's helpful. But to some degree, I usually when I start using stuff like that, it's when the wheels are starting to fall off the wagon and I need to start modifying what I'm doing elsewhere. You know, I need to make sure my sleep's good. I need to make sure that my training is smartly planned and all that sort of stuff. So there's some element to that. You know, there's potentially some built-in, maybe not placebo effect, but it's almost like when people decide that they're going to go on a diet or whatever, it's like, you know, I did great on the zone. You know, it's like, okay, cool. And so what was your alcohol consumption before that? And it's like, I drank a bottle of wine a day. And it's like, okay, so that probably contributed to it in addition to the food changes, you know? So I've seen a lot of people, myself included, when I throw in some of the adaptogens, it's usually when I start getting aware that I'm maybe pushing stuff a little too hard. And so there's some inherent kind of lifestyle modification that needs to go along to work synergistically with that.
Agreed. Rob Wolf, that is it. The end of episode 43. How do you feel?
You know, it's anticlimactic after episode 42 because that was the answer to everything. But I guess we'll just go on.
And so, where are you this weekend? Since we'll post this on Tuesday, so it'll be after. But aren't you heading somewhere this weekend?
We're in Monrovia this weekend, and then the following weekend, September 4th, we're in Brooklyn, New York. September 11th, we're in Atlanta. And then September 14th, we do our kickoff book signing in Ramsey, New Jersey at the Borders Uber Megastore there in Ramsey, New Jersey. And then the John Durant rooftop book signing party in New York City on September 18th. And there may be some other book signings lurking in there. Like the publisher is actually going to has been getting a bunch of requests for me to do some media stuff. So like Men's Health UK wants me to potentially put one of their staff writers through a 30-day paleo challenge and stuff like that and monitor the whole thing. So we may not do as extensive of a book tour when the book first comes out. We may really push the media side of things and try to get on like TV and newspaper and radio and all that. And then in January, do some other books related stuff, maybe even just with the Paleolithic Solution, and just hit some big hub cities and just have folks come in and like hang out and drink some gluten-free beer with us, and I'll sign books and answer questions and just make it after the usual PSS if folks don't want to participate with that, but if they just want to hang out and get a book signed or, you know, whatever. So
Rob Wolf will travel. Well, now we're doing the seminars, or the episodes week to week, Rob, so we will be kept up to date every week about the excitement, and we'll take care of Keystone when you're gone, buddy.
Perfect, man. Now people can see the train crash as it's happening instead of us filming it or, you know, shooting it a couple of weeks ahead of time. So,
well,
perfect.
That's the best way to watch. That's what I always say.
Totally.
All right, Rob. I'll talk to you later, man.
Thanks, Andy.
All right. See you.
Bye.